Louise Brown became world famous 35 years ago when she was the first test tube baby to be born. Since then, millions of children have been conceived and brought into the world using complex reproductive technologies that have sounded like the stuff of science fiction only decades earlier. And they are the subject of this week's Please Explain. Joining us are Dr. Mark V. Sauer, professor and vice chair of obstetrics and gynecology, chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, and program director for the Center for Women's Reproductive Care at Columbia University Medical Center. Also, Dr. Michio Hirano, professor of neurology, chief of the Neuromuscular Disease Division at Columbia University Medical Center. And Dr. Hirano is the co-principal investigator of the North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium, which is doing pioneering work with Dr. Sauer and other team members on something called three-person in vitro fertilization. We invite you, our listeners, to join in the conversation. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WMIC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Doctors, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Sauer, is in vitro the last thing people turn to if all the other methods of getting pregnant have failed?
Well, it used to be that way. Interestingly, these days, it's not uncommon for people to initially present and say, I want to do IVF. So, you know, things have changed a lot in the last three decades that I've been working in the field.
Has there been an increase in infertility rates in this country, or is it just getting more attention than it once did?
I think both. You know, what you notice today, different than before, is the age of the patient. Very commonly, they're older. And in our field, surprising to many people, old might be 35 to 40 years old. So what happens increasingly in an area like Manhattan, where I practice, very successful women who are, you know, pursuing their education, pursuing vocation, doing everything they're supposed to do to be autonomous and successful, suddenly find themselves with infertility only because they've outaged their natural reproductive capacity.
But they're not menopausal yet.
No, not at all.
So what are the most common reasons for infertility in women and then maybe in men?
Well, women and it's a women and male problem. People always are focused on the women. You might be surprised how many times women come in by themselves, assuming it's them, it's their burden, their problem, as childbearing is, only to find out that
because the cultures have done that to women
always
over
has,
the ages.
Always has been, and still definitely is true. The interesting thing, though, is these days the most common thing we see is age-related infertility. So there's nothing physically wrong with the patient. It's just she's older, and it becomes much more difficult to become pregnant. Second most common thing, by the way, right beside that would be male factor infertility, something not quite right with the sperm.
So you test both.
Always
you look at the viability of the eggs and at the and whether the sperm are capable of producing a child?
As best we can. There's a public perception that, you know, we're scientists and we can grade these things and look into the cells and tell what's normal and what's good and bad. In a colloquial sense, again, there's nothing good or bad about an egg or a sperm, but it's really not quite that way. It's more a more crude science than that. So we basically do a general assessment of the patient, the woman and the male, and try to the best of our knowledge, give an assessment as to the likelihood of pregnancy or how abysmal in some cases it might be for them to even attempt these things.
Dr. Hirano, in the last 35 to 40 years, there have been tremendous developments in our understanding of human reproduction and in assisted reproductive technologies. How did this revolution of sorts begin?
Oh, actually, I think I defer to Dr. Sauer. He's the expert in IVF.
Well, I would comment in my lifetime professionally. I've been doing this now about 30 years, so I've been fortunate enough and now to be able to look back and give a little bit of an overview like this. You know, it's an interesting intermix of religion and medicine and social issues, and all these things are evolving within the culture that we practice in. So a lot of things that were quite taboo in medicine and in our field of medicine are now very well accepted. So single women having babies, for instance, that's 20% of my practice. When I started in Los Angeles in the mid-80s, that was considered pretty radical.
But did this also grow out of the other things that were developing in society? For example, the pill. So we were thinking about using technology in this area. Why not apply it the other way?
I don't think it was quite that well thought out. I think it was like a lot of things in medicine, an evolution of events. I would give Bob Edwards, who unfortunately recently died back in the spring, all the credit for being the real founder of the field. Basic scientist by trade, worked for decades on trying to understand how to be able to fertilize eggs both in the body and outside the body. Was able then to get through, again, a lot of barriers, academic barriers, social barriers, religious barriers, to drive the science to a fruition where Louise Brown was ultimately the notorious birth 35 years ago.
And she turned just 35 just last month.
That's correct.
So can you remind us of what test tube baby, which was the phrase that was used,
It's an interesting term because the only test tube involved in this is when we actually aspirate and pull the eggs out of the body and it goes into a little test tube. The rest is actually done in little dishes and in incubators and things like that. But what it really means is that all the normal acts of fertilization and early growth inside the body are done outside the body. So before you implant into your mother's uterus, you actually spend close to a week in her fallopian tube, and that's what we do in the laboratory.
And is it pretty much the same thing as it was 35 years ago?
Very different. Much more sophisticated and much more successful.
Dr. Hirano, do you think that the most recent research is kind of a new frontier?
Oh, yes, if you're referring to our recent collaboration hopefully prevent the transmission of a particular type of mutation in mitochondrial DNA. It is a new area that is hopefully going to prevent transmission of a group of diseases.
And we'll get to that in a little while, because perhaps we have to lay the groundwork for getting to that point. We've kind of covered a bit of it. A person who's unable to conceive a child meets with doctors like you and your teams. So what happens next? So what's a typical process for infertility treatment?
Well, the most typical process probably happens before we ever actually see the patient. It takes a lot of courage and fortitude on the patient's part to actually come and see a physician. There are a lot of people out there with subfertility or worse, and they're getting bad advice, or they're just afraid of seeking medical care, or in many cases they just can't afford care. So once they finally get to someone who can assess it, which I would argue should be a subspecialist, if I had a heart problem, I should see a cardiologist. If I have an infertility problem, I should see a reproductive medicine specialist.
Well, if somebody is having, a couple is having problem getting pregnant, are there things that you can do other than these to encourage pregnancy?
Oh, of course. These days, all of society benefits from the internet in so many ways. I find our patients today are so much more well-informed, and they expect you to be as well. So it definitely expedites a lot of the educational part of this that in the past we would have to start with that. Timing intercourse, what's normal menstruation, what's normal intercourse, believe it or not. You'd be surprised what people think are fertile times or what they're supposed to be
so
doing.
So we're back to the rhythm method in a way? Rhythm method?
It can be. I've seen people who get it wrong, and they're having sex exactly at the wrong time of the month, and they're not getting pregnant. They can't understand why.
My guests are Dr. Mark V. Sauer and Dr. Michio Hirano. We are talking about in vitro fertilization and related technologies on today's Please Explain. Can you describe the process of in vitro fertilization?
You can make it sound scientific and sort of scary, but it's actually really not so difficult. It's basically giving a daily shot of hormone, the same hormone that your body normally pulses to the ovary to tell it to make an egg. The reason it's a shot, which I think people are naturally reluctant to want to invest in that, is because if you ate it, your stomach would denature it and you wouldn't be able to get a response. So you take a daily shot, and it takes about 10 days of these injections to drive the ovary to produce multiple eggs. And then at that point, they're harvested. It's a non-surgical procedure. It's done with a needle. It takes about 10 minutes, and your patient's asleep. And then those eggs are fertilized with the husband's or a partner, or a donor, for that matter, sperm, and the embryos are grown in culture later to be transferred back with a small catheter into the woman's uterus.
And how much do these procedures usually cost?
Good question.
Are they covered by insurance?
very good question, and often misunderstood. It can be quite variable. New York City, for instance, is probably the most expensive place on earth to do in vitro fertilization. But in general, in this country, it can be as cheap as about $10,000 a cycle. That means an attempt. But it can be as much as $20,000 or $30,000, depending upon the complexity of what we're trying to accomplish.
And why is it more expensive in New York than elsewhere? Isn't the process pretty much the same?
I think it's kind of what's true for everything in this town, including where you eat. You know, it's just an expensive town to do business in. But these things are driven by local competition. There's a lot of services in this town, and people will pay what they think they have to pay for these services.
What are the odds for success?
Never an easy answer to that, because it's not a generic statistic. Patients that are good candidates, meaning they're younger, they do produce lots of eggs, the eggs are more normal, you can get pregnancies, and generically speaking, you do get pregnancies about half the time you do it. Or maybe better said, half the time it works, half the time it does not work. On the other hand, an older patient, a patient in her 40s, certainly mid-40s, it could be as low as 1% or 2%. So what often happens is when people fail, and even young people will fail, they say, oh, these therapies are hyped, they're really not so successful, when the reality is, you know, it's well-defined after 30 years, and most of these patients get informed consent, and they know what they're investing in when they start.
Let's take a call from Merrill in Port Washington. Hi, Merrill.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. I was a woman who had my first child naturally at age 40, no problems at all, but tried to have a second child. It seemed like virtually impossible. Tried IVF. That didn't work. Ended up switching doctors, and at 46, with a donor egg of a woman who was in her late 20s, and my husband's sperm had a beautiful boy who's now 6.5 years old, and he is the light of our life. So we do have two children, and very happy about that. But we did go sort of a different route, I guess.
Well, Dr. Sauer, weren't you one of the pioneers of donor eggs?
I was involved in this from the beginning. I don't know if that makes me a pioneer, just an old guy. But yeah, I've been involved in this now for almost 30 years. And thank you for the call. That was a very good point, because there's a lot of different kind of families out there today. There's two things I would emphasize in what she just said. One, just because you're 40 doesn't mean you can't have a baby. I have a lot of patients that we would prescribe birth control pills because they don't want to have a baby, and they might be 40 or even 45 years old. So there is a misconception that you turn 40 and suddenly it's impossible unless you do donor egg. The reality is there's quite a few very fertile 40-year-old women.
How are donor eggs chosen? How are they screened?
Well, in general, the way they should be performed, and again, there's variations to the theme, it would be either by a physician group like at Columbia. We have our own registry. We do our own screening. And these are, these days, usually solicited women in their 20s through Time Out New York, Craigslist, lots of different venues where young people read. And then they're screened by social workers, physicians, and staff as to their suitability to donate eggs.
Dr. Hirono, you've been very quiet. Is there anything we're going to be getting to your specialty in a little while, but is there anything you want to add to this discussion so far?
As a neurologist, I interact with Dr. Sauer and the IVF team in a variety of situations where a family has a genetic disorder, and they're often concerned about that, and sometimes IVF can be used as a way of preventing transmission of a variety of genetic conditions. And perhaps Dr. Sauer can comment on that.
Yes, thanks, Mitch, for mentioning that. IVF isn't what it was when we started. It's not just about fertility. A lot of the things that we do today, really more medical, were a nice liaison to genetics and medicine. So,
because you want to make sure that the child is a healthy child.
We want to prevent disease, and we have the means now to do that, which was just a dream, again, 30 years ago, that we might be able to do some of these things. Or other examples, fertility preservation for cancer patients who have a real need because they're facing a very big struggle with cancer, and they know these diseases, it may either kill them or take away their fertility if they're lucky enough to survive, and many these days most actually do.
Cancer treatments often undermine their fertility. Our ability to have a child.
That's right, both men and women, by the way. Mm-hmm. So being able to, the cryobiology, the ability to freeze eggs, sperm, and embryos today are really getting quite good, and that allows us to preserve fertility.
We're going to take a little break and come back with more of your calls. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org. You can reach us on Facebook or Twitter as well, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. The number is 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Mark V. Sauer, Professor and Vice Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, and Program Director for the Center for Women's Reproductive Care at Columbia University Medical Center, and Dr. Michio Hirano, a professor of neurology, chief of the neuromuscular disease division at Columbia University Medical Center, and a co-principal investigator of the North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium, which we will be discussing after we come back from this break. We are back with today's Please Explain look at in vitro fertilization and related technologies with Drs. Mark V. Sauer and Dr. Michio Hirano. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go to a caller. This is it Chris? No, Gina from Manhattan. Hi, Gina. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
I was calling because I'm over 40, and I've been trying to get pregnant. And I've got a great doctor who I love, but they've told me I need to take a mitochondrial optimizer with BioPQQ. And it's one of these things you just sort of order over the Internet, and it comes. And, you know, I've got 20 different things I'm taking. I'm just wondering if your experts there can say, like, what are their top three tips, alternative natural supplements otherwise, that can be helpful for women over 40.
And let's get into the whole matter of mitochondria. Dr. Hirano, can you tell us a bit about what you've been doing?
Well, as a neurologist, I've been studying mitochondrial disorders for a little over 20 years, and these are a bunch of very heterogeneous disorders, which can be due to mutations in either the nuclear DNA or the mitochondria's own DNA, mitochondrial DNA. And so these are rare disorders, but can be very devastating. And so that's how I got into mitochondrial work.
Well, how do they apply to pregnancy?
Yeah, so there is a group of people that believe that a lot of the phenomenon of aging are related to degeneration of mitochondria over time. There's a mitochondrial theory of aging, that the mitochondria, because they generate energy and produce a lot of reactive oxygen species, which are damaging, cause damage that just accumulates with age. So that may contribute to, some people believe it may contribute to things like infertility, hearing loss, vision loss later in life, although the data are controversial.
Aren't the mitochondria used to trace our maternal lineages?
Oh, yes, because mitochondria and mitochondrial DNA are exclusively maternally transmitted from women to children. So they've been used to study the origins of human, to identify the mitochondrial Eve from which all of us descended.
How does in vitro fertilization factor into your work with mitochondrial diseases?
Well, in vitro fertilization can be used in two ways, and Mark Sauer, certainly you can chime in at any point and correct anything I say that's incorrect. But there are two ways. One is that you can do in vitro fertilization and pluck out a single cell of an embryo after the in vitro fertilization and look at the genetics of that embryo and determine if it has a high level of a particular mitochondrial DNA mutation. Mitochondrial DNA is different from nuclear DNA because there are hundreds of copies of mitochondrial DNA per cell, so you can have a variable level of mutation. So you can do this screening, pre-gestational screening, where you pluck out a single cell from an embryo and determine the level of mitochondrial DNA mutation, and a higher level would predict a worse outcome. But unfortunately, picking a single egg may not be a good representative of what's going on in the whole embryo, because the level of mutation can vary from cell to cell. So it only applies to a certain group of mitochondrial DNA mutations that you can do this technology. There, The alternative is a new technology, which is just being developed in the experimental stage at this point, where you take an egg or a group of eggs from a woman with a mitochondrial DNA mutation, and you pluck out the nucleus from that egg, and you then insert that nucleus into the cytoplasm of a donor egg, which has normal mitochondrial DNA.
This is three-person IVF?
Exactly, three-person IVF. So you have nuclear DNA from the biological mother and father, and then you have a donor who supplies the mitochondrial DNA from the cytoplasm of an egg.
Wow, that sounds complicated. Now, yeah. I don't know how that applies to Gina's question, but let's get back to the whole business of a mitochondrial optimizer. What's a mitochondrial optimizer?
Let me address that. And what Michino was saying is an exciting development in our field, and I think will come to fruition in this country and other countries outside the states in the next year or two, in addressing mitochondrial diseases, which are heartbreaking to families who suffer from with them, usually with children that have them.
What kinds of diseases are we talking about?
Usually neurodegenerative diseases, but there are quite a few of them. I believe 1 in 4,000 children are born with a mitochondrial disease state. And unfortunately, oftentimes the parents don't know they are at risk for having a child with such an illness until they actually give birth to one. But what the caller is addressing is a different issue, and I think it brings up a very different question, which is, can you optimize an older woman's eggs by sort of quote-unquote juicing up the egg with antioxidants, vitamin E, vitamin C's? I don't think there's any evidence basis behind that at all, and unfortunately I think these alternative therapies actually do more harm than good, in the sense that it gives women a false belief that you can treat an egg and make it something better than whatever it may actually be. That, I don't think, is likely to work. It probably doesn't do any harm, because most of these therapies are vitamin-based, and vitamins are vitamins. But really, if a woman has very poor egg quality and ends up having a very difficult time getting pregnant, there's, at this point in time at least, nothing you can really much do about that other than these therapies and hope that they actually work.
Gina?
Yes.
I'm sorry about the answer, but does that help you at all?
The second part of the question was actually, that is helpful, but the second part of the question is there like sort of a top three things that you can recommend for women over 40 trying to get pregnant to just, you know, general health, not necessarily just the mitochondria, but, you know, is it the CoQ10 or what is it that you recommend?
Honestly, I don't recommend anything more than a good prenatal vitamin, because, you know, also remember that many vitamins, most of these, again, are vitamin-based supplements. A lot of them are fat-soluble, and believe it or not, a lot of women can overdose on fat-soluble vitamins, and that can actually be a problem for embryos and fetuses, causing, you know, anomalies. So everything in a good vitamin and a good American diet is probably adequate, and I don't know of any data, and if Mitch has some mitochondrial enhancer that I don't know, maybe he'd love to hear it, but I can't think of anything that is clearly going to make a difference that way.
Do you have anything else you want to say, Dr. Hirano?
No. We treat people with mitochondrial disorders with a cocktail of vitamins and supplements. Frankly, I don't see any objective changes, although patients report some subjective increased energy. So I advise people to take these supplements if they have a mitochondrial disorder, but I wouldn't necessarily prescribe it to people who are otherwise healthy.
Let's go to another call. Lule from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting show. I just actually wanted to convey my story to you. I'm married to a woman. I had a baby through IVF at age 39. We have a beautiful baby girl now. And one of the things that we always joke about is we say sort of IVF is God's way of saying I'm sorry to women for making them so fertile so young, because it's made a big difference in our ability to have a child. But there are things that we learned about that I feel like women don't know about that might be helpful. For instance, as you know, we actually had to buy the sperm, right, from a donor bank. So every time we got the sperm, it was very expensive. And so one of the things that we did was, I think it's called ISIS. It increased the chance of fertilization. I don't know if many women know about it, but it was very helpful in helping us sort of get pregnant faster, but also curbing our costs in terms of the overall cost of getting pregnant.
Is she referring to intercytoplasmic sperm injection?
What you're referring to is called ICSI in our medical terms, ICSI. And the reason it was probably done at the center that you went is because there is some data. We actually contributed to studies on this where frozen thawed sperm may fertilize better in vitro when it's performed as a sperm injected into the egg to increase the number of eggs that fertilize and therefore the number of embryos that we can use. But in fairness, the medical literature actually would also suggest that people, especially doing IVF with frozen donor sperm, would not necessarily need ICSI. And why do I care? Only because, as you probably firsthand experienced, ICSI costs a lot more money than just regular IVF. So physicians will differ on that. I would, in our particular program at Columbia, we recommend ICSI for frozen donor sperm for the exact reasons that you mentioned, to try to improve fertilization, but it wouldn't have to be done.
Okay. Thank you for calling us. A number of listeners have written in with questions. One wonders if over-the-counter ovulation predictors are accurate.
They're very accurate when performed correctly. So you can take any kit, no matter how good it is, and botch it, you know, by not following the directions. But they are accurate, and what they basically tell you in advance that you're going to ovulate with about 99% certainty in the following 24 to 48 hours. So it gives people a heads up that it's a fertile time.
Another person, Amy from Manhattan, asks, can eggs and sperm intended for IVF by couples who want to avoid passing on genes for diseases be screened before fertilization to detect and eliminate those genes?
It's difficult to screen the gamete. It's much easier to screen the patient and then ultimately the embryos. So these days, for most known single-gene mutational disorders, and there's a lot of them nowadays that we know about, usually the embryos are screened in a process termed PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So it's a type of IVF where the embryos are produced, and as Dr. Arano mentioned, then we biopsy the embryo, determine which ones are not affected with the disorder so they can be safely transferred back to the mother.
Dr. Hirano, is this three-person IVF that you were talking about something that's being worked on around the world, or is there just a specific team that you're involved with?
Well, it's being investigated heavily in the UK by a group in Newcastle upon Tyne, and also a couple of groups here in the United States, here at Columbia, and also in Oregon.
Dr. Sarah, you're on the Ethics Committee of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, the Ethics Committee of the New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, and the Editorial Board of the American Journal of Bioethics. Can you talk about some of the questions that are most often asked when reproductive technologies are being discussed?
Oh, there's so many. You know, who should get access to the care, whether the therapy is natural or should just be banned outright. That goes back all the way to before Louise Brown. I'd say
because there are religious objections.
Religious objections, you know, misuse questions. A lot of people take offense to single women and lesbians and gay males accessing these therapies. So, you know, you will see a broad array, and culturally too, in some societies that might offer it in one place, not offer it in another.
We had a recent guest who had written a book about her experiences where IVF actually failed, but she said that she felt that despite being discouraged when she finally was told, well, all it takes is one good egg, she's willing to take the chance, and perhaps the doctor should have told her that there was very little possibility, and she felt that was unethical.
Well, you know, I actually heard that show. Perhaps he did. You know, I have to respond to that in the sense of I don't really believe that patients are intentionally misled and that the care being given is exploiting. I think, you know, it's like any disease or any pathology in medicine. There's a lot of denial. There's a lot of hope, of course, and the doctors are here to service the patient's needs. Hopefully, giving good informed consent, which includes a reasonable appraisal of the likelihood of success. A woman in her 40s is going to have a low success rate, but not a no success rate. So it's up to them to decide if it's really worth their while to try.
Dr. Hirano, how close do you think we are to a successful three-person IVF?
Well, it's technically feasible, I think, in the next few weeks, but
the next few weeks.
But there are a lot of regulatory issues that have to be dealt with, as well as ethical issues, and so I think this has to be dealt with at the governmental level. In the UK, it's being addressed, as well as it will be addressed. It'll have to be addressed by the Food and Drug Administration here in the U.S.
And Dr. Sauer, are there other technologies on the horizon?
Well, I think we're just continually improve what we already have. I'm sure there are other technologies that I don't even know about coming in the horizon. But, you know, we've gotten so much better with our methods, our tools, the imaging, the drugs, the culture systems, the incubators, everything really ultimately translates to better success.
We have very little time, but another listener wanted to know whether women are experiencing infertility more now because of environmental concerns.
There's some evidence of that. The air quality is not as good. There's a lot of hormones in our food, and the water is probably contaminated and on. But, you know, it's always going to be here. I think patients, if they suspect they have a problem, my advice is always seek care early. Go to your OBGYNs. Go to your reproductive specialists.
And my thanks to both of you for participating in today's Please Explain Look at IVF and Related Technologies. Dr. Mark V. Sauer, Professor and Vice Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility, and Program Director for the Center for Women's Reproductive Care at Columbia University Medical Center. And Dr. Michio Hirono, Professor of Neurology, Chief of the Neuromuscular Disease Division at Columbia University Medical Center, and a co-principal investigator of the North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, journalist Janine DiGiovanni talks about how rape is being used as a weapon of war by both sides in the Syrian conflict. And then we'll look at Long Island's Sylvester Manor, which was founded as a northern slave plantation more than 300 years ago. Peter Gethers talks about his novel Ask Bob, about a veterinarian who should follow the advice he shares in his weekly newspaper column. Plus, New York Times reporter Elizabeth Rosenthal discusses the latest installment in her year-long series about the cost of health care in the United States. This one looks at medical tourism. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Bill O'Neill was at the audio controls. And we had help today from Nolan Miller and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Bonnie LaFave. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.